I work with all men, so I'm used to it. Bring it.
Well, there's no men here. We're all nerds. You won't get any manly behavior out of us. Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology, and work life in the networking industry. During the week, we gather articles and various ideas and then get together to flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around the workbench and diagnose the problems of the networking world with wit, humor, and just maybe even some technical talent. And speaking of technical talent around the virtual workbench, this week I'd like to welcome back John McManus. John, how's it going?
Yeah, it's good, Greg. Enjoyed having a few beers with you this week.
Yeah, that's right. It almost feels like it was so long ago I'd forgotten about that. It was really good to meet you for the first time, by the way, after all the time we've been banging away at each other on the internet.
Yes, you too. I hope you cut that phrase out of the final cut.
Well, in Australia, that means something different. Bang on means to talk and carry on regardless of what people think.
It's cool. You know, in Glasgow, it means something completely different as well.
This show is never culturally relevant. Thank you very much. And also with us this week is Tom Hollingsworth. Tom, what's been happening in your neck of the woods?
Oh, I traveled all week, so I've been spending the weekend trying to catch up on the mountain of email that somehow managed to find its way into my inbox and try to come up with some good discussion topics for the show.
I think we've got plenty of topics this week. The industry's been busy giving us things to talk about.
Indeed.
Indeed. And our special guest this week shall only be known as Mrs. Y. Please introduce yourself, Mrs. Y.
Hi. So I work in EDU. And I've been in the industry for about 14 years. I actually have a liberal arts degree background. I know. Okay, enough.
Did I say that out loud?
Like most EDU types, I started out doing one thing, and I was an NT4 Citrix admin. I did some Unix administration and engineering. And then I ended up in networking, where everybody goes to die, I guess, in IT.
I don't see it that way. When I arrived in networking, I went, this is where I wanted to be. I'd gone through working on DOS and LANMAN and Netware Lite, Novell Netware version 1.
And yeah, how old are you?
And then I was in the fast track for Windows NT 3.0. You know, this is after Windows for Workgroups and Windows 90, you know, and after 2 years of working on Windows NT, I went, I just so do not want to be working on this product. Because it was a buggy piece of rubbish back in 1996, and I can promise you that today it's no better than it was after 15 years of development, billions of dollars of work. It's still horrendously problematic. So when I got to networking, I went, I've arrived. I've been waiting to be here all my life. So.
Well, I noticed, I looked around and I noticed that the networking guys seemed to be the most laid back and they were in the best physical condition because I was around a bunch of Unix engineers for years. I mean, you just, you know, the pasty complexion, you know, the smokers, they decrepit. And I went, okay, I gotta get a lifestyle change. So I ended up in networking, and I do I specialize in security, network security. Basically, what happened was the routing switching guys went, well, we don't want to touch that network security stuff because it's not real network equipment. So we'll give it to her. So I ended up with the load balancers, VPN, firewalls.
That's more than a packet.
Yeah, and anything that was a complete and utter implementation disaster. You know, just completely Byzantine in its, you know,
when you had to know more than just frames, packets, and routing protocols. I get stuck with that all the time. It seems to me in the organizations I'm working in, I'm the only one who can spell HTTP or DNS or, you know.
Yeah, I gutted the DNS architecture where I work because nobody else wanted it. I'm so clueless. I went, well, why don't I just fix that? It's kind of messed up.
It's kind of obvious, isn't it? You know, it's like, but you've got Unix skills, so you would have been able to configure a bind file. And
oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the Unix guys would have said, well, we don't want to do that, but we trust her because she's been one of us.
Right.
And the networking guys would have gone, that's Unix. We don't want anything to do with that. Yeah.
I'm in a weird place because I'm referred to, I actually have some emotional and social intelligence skills and in my environment. So my boss calls me the bridge. And sometimes I feel like the bridge to nowhere, but that's what pretty much my role now. I work between teams and, you know, the telecom guys and the networking guys or the systems guys and the networking guys, or, you know, I'm the only one who will talk to the security team from networking. So.
It's a good place to be, though, because you know everything that's going on. And inevitably, you end up looking astonishingly intelligent because you actually know stuff that isn't, you know, you just know what's up, you know.
Shh, don't give away my secret.
That's the one. All this chit-chat is all very fine and good, but it isn't getting us on with the topics of the show. I think the first thing that we wanted to talk about this week was the RSA breach, which is... given me no end of giggles all week. For those of you who don't know, RSA was breached in what they called an advanced persistent threat, which is fancy language for getting pwned. It got slammed, and it's been pretty interesting fun. The first thing that they did was they said that we've been owned and some sort of a breach. We don't know what's been gone, but we think they got the good stuff. But don't ask any questions. We won't tell you any lies. Hold that thought, and if you're a customer, you can contact us to and we'll give you a special message. Since then, today they've just released an email which talked about the a blog post which will be in the show notes, where they talk about the anatomy of the attack. And so, get this, strap yourself in, kids, get a big breath of air because you're gonna laugh. This email was crafted well enough to trick one of the employees to retrieve it from their junk mail folder and to open the attached Excel file. It was a spreadsheet titled 2011 recruitmentplan.xls. The spreadsheet contained a zero-day exploit that installs a backdoor through an Adobe Flash vulnerability. As a side note, Adobe has reached a patch for the zero-day. All right, rock on. So you've got an employee who gets a spreadsheet in the junk mail folder who owns it, and then they've managed to compromise that machine and escalate that into the machines to steal the seed code for the tokens. So,
well, we don't. I mean, there's a lot of assumptions about whether or not the seeds have been.
They specifically referred to that in their first blog post. They say, open letter, our investigation has led us to believe certain information being extracted. Some of that information is specifically related to the SecureID two-factor authentication products.
And so, yeah, and you could make the leap that it was the seeds, I guess. They haven't actually said it, though.
No, they haven't.
Well, I think that's the worst
part. Gibson went a long way to say, well, if they've only got one part of the two-factor, it doesn't really make any difference. It's the fact they've got to have two parts of the puzzle to make it a real threat. So I think assumptions that he's drawn from that is that, yeah, they've got the keys to the kingdom, effectively.
Well, yeah, and, you know, everybody's passwords are completely secure. As one of the things that we know from all the recent breaches around passwords is it's not really that difficult to crack a password.
Well, my feeling was that I thought, well, yeah, they could have gotten the seeds. I was wondering if they were going for something bigger, but if they were using poison ivy, I don't think that these are, you know, the level of really advanced APT guys. I mean, I was thinking maybe they were trying to get a backdoor in the source code, you know, but because that would have been really sexy, but and very impressive.
Yeah,
they're using poison ivy, you know, a standard rat. I'm not thinking that they were very.
Tom, you were going to say.
Well, I think the worst part is that RSA hasn't actually said anything. This seriously starts to sound like some CIA level, you know, nothing happened, nothing ever occurred on this day kind of thing. If they would just come out and even hint at, you know, there's a possibility that some of our tokens may have become compromised, and then start working with customers to replace those tokens. And, you know, they don't necessarily even have to do it for free, maybe a nominal shipping charge or something like that. Take your black eye. Understand how this is going to make you a better security company, and even turn it into a case study. Because, like Mrs. Y was saying, if this was like a very well crafted attack that was, you know, a real APT, kind of like the Gmail hacking from a year ago, where they got in and were persistent for several months and could set up all kinds of very interesting hacks and holes in the source code, that would be one thing. And from what you're saying, Ms. Y, it sounds like you think that this was just a guy who got really lucky with the machine he compromised.
I took a Metasploit class from Val Smith, and he's a friend of a friend, and I spent some time. He's one of the Metasploit contributors and one of the major people who works on that project. When he talked about how they do penetration tests, you're going to go to somebody like Val Smith to do a penetration test of the engagement is a year. He's going to do some passive footprinting. He's going to, use very, very, he's not doing Nmap scans. If he's doing an Nmap scan, he's scanning one port. He's going to very subtly get in, exploit trusts between systems, get everything he can exfiltrate out. I mean, I don't find that somebody who's using your standard poison ivy, and wrapper to be that advanced.
It's kind of the difference between someone who would just, drive up to a convenience store with a gun and rob it without a second thought versus someone who has been casing a bank for several months and learning the ins and outs so that he can get in and get out without being seen, kind of mentality extracted to the cybersecurity level.
Yeah, and I, as an RSA customer, first of all, they didn't contact us. We didn't even get the email. What happened was our security team, the director of our security team, I was in a CEH boot camp class the week it happened, ironically, and I passed. You can refer to me also as Your Majesty. There was a meltdown, a mini meltdown at work, and senior management is like trying to call me, and they're like, Michelle, what do you think? Because for some reason, don't ask me why, our networking group manages the RSA Secure ID server. It's very political, and it was very weird how it happened, but I actually built the original system. So my director calls me because the security director called him. I did a lot. I spent about 2 hours doing research and calling RSA saying, hey, how come you guys didn't call us, to find out that nobody knew anything. I assumed the worst. I said, be prepared to ask them to replace tokens. But then a friend of mine said, okay, don't get them replaced yet because they're just going to take them out of stock until they read, they're going to have to throw away all those tokens, because if the seed file was compromised and they had back stock, then those seeds are compromised too. Wait like 3 or 4 months, change all the pins, which is kind of a pain with, if you don't have, is it four? Do you need to increase it? You need to tell everybody, it's like you got to go through change management. I mean, it was painful already, so.
I think there's a couple of things going on. I mean, in terms of practical actions, one of the things that I've been recommending is that you should immediately stop issuing IT or secured stuff with security tokens and block them, because you have to regard them as compromised. And if you do need to use tokens to be compliant with your policy, you need to go and buy another vendor's product immediately, because the secure ID can't be trusted until it's been validated as what was lost or what was not lost.
Wow, that's hardcore.
I mean, well, that's what you have to do. You don't know if the security tokens are broken or not. I mean, even if they've got the seed file, right, it's easy enough to guess a username and a password, because most people are using crap passwords.
Yeah, I mean, I was more nervous that they had backdoored it. I mean, there's still going to be some work involved in, they've got to get your usernames, or, can they figure out the username? How long is it going to take them? How much time is it worth? Do you have the data that they want? Is there an easier way for them to exfiltrate the data anyway?
If they've been in the system for some months, which is what they have, the question is how many backdoors up there?
Yeah, exactly.
From a practical point of view, RSA doesn't know, and we will never know how deep it goes. So you really have to regard all RSA products as compromised until proven otherwise.
Yeah.
You can't have a reasonable security perspective on this at all. Security policies and strategies of today says if the company cannot tell you what it is, it's presumed to be broken.
And that's why, it's interesting that the Strategic Studies Quarterly that came out, everybody has been talking about some of the articles in that. That was some of the other stuff I attached to the notes. and about, you know, the general, one of the generals who wrote the introduction said, you know, okay, is cyber really a domain like land, air, and sea? You know, and we focus a lot of energy on getting, keeping people out when the reality is it's like we're in this utter state of denial of, you know, you when you put a lock on your door, you know that if they want to get in, they can get in that lock.
Yeah.
They can break it. But we're in this state of denial about our perimeter security. And we think, you know, we're not prepared for recovery. We never talk about it.
No.
Okay. If we get pwned, you know, or when we get pwned, you know, how are we going to respond? And basically, it seems like RSA just is a perfect example in the industry of they really didn't have a strategy or plan for that.
Okay, there's two things that come out of this that I would take. One of the first things is that they are running a genius level media campaign to keep this under control. Now, I would guess that they're actually doing it with government assistance, so it's particularly U.S. government assistance, right? So I would guess the reason that you're not seeing an awful lot of hype is the FBI, the CIA, you know, all those types of funny three-letter acronyms associated with spooky people who are usually just stupid because their level of security, you know, their paranoia about security is much greater than their actual what they're doing about it. But they're doing as much as they can to keep this as quiet as possible because they don't want it to be outed that their fundamental security policies have been busted wide open.
Well, who's one of the biggest customers of RSA?
Exactly. Yeah, the American government, right? So
right.
The RSA is running a masterful campaign on suppressing this as a major issue. How many people have really gone, RSA, damages in court, now, right? Because that's what should be happening. If this was anybody else, like, you know, remember Heartland had that breach of payment systems? It took 3 days for the first lawsuit to come out of the traps. And the RSA, by sitting there saying, we don't know, we're not telling you, they're trying to play out the media game for as long as possible. Now, I'm guessing they have a media strategy for this in place as part of their security plan, because it's been far too slick right from the front. It's been, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to tell it. We're not going to tell you what's going to happen, we'll come to that later. And if you're a customer, come and talk to us. And so the feedback I've had from people who are customers who've contacted RSA is, guess what? We can't tell you, we don't know, we'll get in contact with you when we know something.
It's a complete wall.
They're trying to wash it clean.
Yeah, you can't get anything out of them. I mean, they're not really talking to us. You call them and they basically they regurgitate the same, yes, you know, official
story.
Whereas
if they had said, so if you look at it from a practical point of view, from a PR or a marketing perspective, if they had said we've been breached and we're broken, everybody would have run away. If they had said we've lost nothing, but we've had a breach, but we don't know what, you know, you can't win that. So they've walked the middle road, and now what they're doing is delaying it out so that it passes away from the memory and it's not a big deal. And at some time in a few weeks' time when everybody's sort of forgotten all about it, they'll put something out and nobody will kind of, it won't be a big issue. This is a huge issue in my view. RSA has busted themselves. Now, the second thing is that if you're a person inside of RSA, the preeminent global supplier of security technologies at so many levels, we're talking, an $8 billion security company with 30 years of security history. And this person who took a spreadsheet that had access got to get into the secured system that holds the secure ID code. The fact that they even think that that's possible tells me that their internal security must have been less than excellent. Is that what you say?
Yeah, you got human beings that people do stupid things. that's the first problem with security, you know?
Mm.
You know, that's how Mitnick got some of his best ends, just through social engineering.
Yeah, but surely the code, you know, or, you know, the bits that run, just that bit, should have been somewhere else inside a system that would have been carved away from the main corporate network.
I think what happened was they might have exploited trust, and which is, you know, that's, you know, you get in, then you escalate privilege so you can, you know, stay in. Then you see it's a chain. It's just a daisy chain, and you just keep hopping until you get where you need to go. And it takes one simple mistake, you know, one zero day patched.
But that's a bit different from, like, you know, if I'm working for Company X or Company Y, if Company X gets breached, Company X goes down. We're talking about a security company that maintains the security systems for 60% of the world's companies and governments. surely they must have had something a little bit more grown up than, oh, that'll do. We'll have a firewall.
Yeah, it could have been one of those deals where it was a developer that decided to get lazy. He was tired of getting up and walking across the room to access the secure terminal to get to the seed values.
But
and so he said, you know what,
childish to think that a company with the security profile and the security awareness, whose core business is security, whose only meaning in life is to provide security, develop security, deliver security, hasn't got a security policy internally. Like, here's the classic part, right? Favorite part from the blog post that came up just recently, is it says right here at the bottom, at RSA we're already learning fast, both making small-term hardening moves and giant strides towards establishing a whole new defense doctrine. We're implementing techniques that just a couple of weeks ago I thought were in the realm of long-term roadmaps.
I'm really not shocked or surprised because yep. I, in my talks with security companies and pen testers, and I'm never surprised by how much.
Well, I read this to say, we're in the realm of long-term roadmaps as, oh, the budget's suddenly been approved.
Yeah.
Yeah? Yeah.
Could be, yeah.
I've got techniques that have been on a roadmap for years as well. And they would be just approved about 2 minutes after a breach has been gone public, wouldn't it?
No, there's no budget for this.
Yeah.
They were probably told, fix this. I don't care what it costs because our stock's going to take such a huge hit about it. Yeah. I want to be able to go to the public in 3 weeks and say, we have put great new things and great new ideas in place and, you know, whatever, because if you don't do it, we're going to fire you.
Yeah. Now, let me make one other point about RSA and their tokens. One thing to remember is that for every token that RSA has issued, they retain the ability to federate that token. Now, what that means is that Company A and Company B decide that they want to trust each other's tokens. RSA can provide a federation service that actually allows those to be merged into a single thing. So if, even if they don't haven't given away the seeds, but somebody's got access to the federated trust system, then you've got a much worse problem than you can imagine.
Hmm.
That's the one. If you can crack the federation system, you've got every token everywhere in the world for every company that was ever issued is the worst case scenario of that.
Well, what's been surprising me is I've not really seen any other vendors, competitors, making a big deal about this, saying, no, that SA is obviously not all it's cracked up to be. No, here's another alternative.
It's not just RSA. I mean, the emperor has no clothes in the security industry. I mean, I've been hearing, you know, we've got thousands and thousands of products and IDSs, IPSs, and, you know, DLP prevention devices, and you buy more, you know, proxy servers and this, and it's like you get product after product after product, and they're so limited, you find out that they just, none of them really... So much of it is roadmap, and so little of it actually delivers on the promises that they offer you. And I think maybe what's going on in the security industry is the only people I'm hearing grumbling are, you know, the pen testers and the hacker community or the gray hats and you know, stuff like that. I'm not hearing, from the industry itself, because maybe they're afraid that they'll get the fingers pointed at them next.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like the blue wall, with cops. It's just, you don't roll on your brother cop.
I agree with you. I think the whole thing's being whitewashed. If it's not coming as whitewashed from the RSA or even its customers who have a stake in not making too much of a deal out of it, I think you're right. Security people don't want to be sitting there saying, you know, even their competitors aren't coming out because they're sort of going, ooh, I wonder if we're secure. It just seems to me like everybody's sort of going like, I don't think I'll cast the first stone.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, who's the guy that was, what was it, MySQL.com is, they found a SQL injection.
Hmm. Yeah, that happened last week.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, and if you start pointing fingers, somebody then is going to go, oh yeah, look what I just found on your site, you know, or I found in your network. I mean, it's just, it's a little over, and it's so overwhelming, because how do you keep up with it all?
Yeah, I don't know how many people are actually running proxy servers on their gateway that scans inbound mail and HTTP web traffic so that they can actually block outbound. My understanding is a lot of companies actually don't block anything leaving their network.
Oh, yeah.
They prevent it coming in, but there's nothing stopping stuff from leaving.
Well, you know, so you build a network for rocking speed, right? You know, you build it to maximize speed, and then you put these crap devices in line that half of them, I mean, how many of them actually do 10 gig? How many of them actually do line speed?
Yeah, that's
you know?
Right.
So you put in a choke point.
Yeah.
Great.
But, I mean, the other point is that I know I've been having a quiet giggle. We'll talk more about Cisco's SecureX strategy, so-called SecureX strategy, in a little bit. But
there will be a short conversation.
It will be a short conversation. is that, you know, the old days of firewalls on the perimeter are over, and we need to be moving to. But the problem that you've got is that the security industry is full of idiots who want to over-egg the. I work with a team of security people right now, and these so-called security professionals, fair dinkum, they're flat out tying their shoelaces without having an audit and a pen test. And I'm going, but that's not what the security problem is. The security problem is from, you know, all these other different vectors of attack. What happens if someone brings an iPad in? What happens if somebody plugs it into the network? And they go, well, we don't allow that. That's not in the policy.
Oh,
you know, or that business risk has been accepted. You know, this the current practice is to say, well, we elucidate the business risk, and then a manager signs off on it and says that's okay. So we don't have any 802.1x, we don't have any access lists, we have no VLAN controls. So anybody can come in, plug a laptop in, and away you go.
Well, welcome to EDU. That's our that's my life.
Yeah.
No, I mean, we're connected to I2. We're, you know, we the whole nature of the network is supposed to be open. You know, we work with faculty. I mean, we have Koreans, Chinese, people from the Middle East. I mean, Africa, what do you do? I mean, and they want to bring iPads in. They want to bring the Korean version of Windows Vista. We got to do it, you know?
Yeah, but if there's somewhere secret inside your organization, you make it somewhere else. You put it in its own physically separate network with its own set of controls that are different from the rest of the network.
Which we do, yes.
Yes, right? So, yes, all grown up and adult-like.
But I mean, there's something has to shift in the security culture in terms of that idea of hacking yourself secure is so dead. Hmm. You know, that idea that failing to integrate security into the beginning of the PMLC process, you know, the SDLC process, is that's where the problem is. If you're, and that's a huge fight. I mean, I had a conversation with our web development team last week, and I said, you guys, don't wait till the end and then do the penetration test, and then you're at a complete stopping point while you try to fix things. And
you need to send your programmers to a training course on secure development.
Yeah, good luck. I mean, you know, they don't, they're focused on development. And when you say the word, you've got to go to some SANS classes, you've got to go to some, you know, OWASP, you know, integrate OWASP standards. They're just like,
But that's because I have a pet theory that the security industry has been crying wolf for the better part of 20 years.
To get big paychecks and, you know, lots of money. And,
and argued about silly things like, you know, I had a data center I did once. It was only a small thing for a small company. You know, they only had 350 employees or something. And they had a computer room which was, you know, built inside of the office. And so they had a security audit that was done because they had to be compliant with something or another. And the security audit failed them because the data center, you could climb into the data center over the roof, right? Through the open door. Because the data center was never locked, but the security, you know, he said, oh, well, the door could be locked, but you could never fix the roof problem. And I was just sitting there going, like, you know. And then they failed as they put glass panels onto the data center side so that they could see and let light into it, like natural light into, you know, and they failed us on that because you're not allowed to see the computers. But what they missed was the fact that I'd left three rules in the firewall. They didn't pick that up at all. Three clear breaches. So they failed us on the obvious and missed the technically challenging. You know, any number of horror stories for security, you know, experiences. I'm sure you've got the same thing.
Well, one of our data centers used to be under the bathrooms in the art department. And we have something that we kindly refer to as the shit storm, because the bathrooms overflowed and that weekend. Did you know you could pay in those? This was like 10 years ago. Did you know that you could pay Sun Microsystems to come out and clean their hard drives with SD alcohol and Q-tips?
How would you like to have been the Sun engineer that got that call?
Dude, I wouldn't walk in that data center for like weeks. I'm going, no way. We had people who had to get hepatitis shots.
That's crazy. I've been in some bad ones. I did one in an abattoir once. And there's, it's actually not an abattoir, it's the bit that processes the post bit. So that all the bits that come off the animals, you know, the hooves and the heads and the tongues and the, you know, all the bits you can't lose. And then what happens is it goes to this plant where it gets rendered down into, turned into like non stuff, whatever it is that's left over. And it was post food grade at that point. It'd be, you know, all the stuff that didn't get consumed but was still animal fat and then could be boiled down for lard or whatever it was. But the stench from this stuff was just unbelievable. It never came off your clothes or your body, and you reeked for days afterwards. You just never wanted to be there. Yeah. Shock and stuff.
Smells like RSA right now.
Yeah, to some extent. I just find it difficult to accept that nobody's kicking up a stink about RSA and that the press doesn't seem to be a part of it, and all of our supposedly security watching agencies and things like that haven't done anything about it. Is that... And I can't get the feeling that it's either a masterful media campaign.
I think it's more just over. We're on overload. It's like, yeah, here's another one.
Yeah, that's very possible.
I think that's what it is.
I think as well, a lot of the organizations don't really want to wake up to the fact that they could be compromised, so we just don't talk about it.
Yeah, right.
Maybe
right.
We'll get to a point where RSA will release something meaningful that allows us just to continue on the way we are. Maybe they'll send out Dremel drills to all their customers so they can just score off the serial numbers on all their tokens.
That's right. And it's just unbelievably bad. So one other thing, let's continue off the security thing. Of course, the other big security news is that Komodo is a company who owns the SSL root certificates, and they delegate intermediate certificate authority to a wide range of resellers who then proceed to make whopping sums of money out of selling certificates that cost absolute pennies on the dollar to make. And somebody managed to hack into one of these resellers, not surprisingly, and generate fake certificates for Google.com, Yahoo, and Skype, for example. In fact, a whole range of them. Who's been following that one? Anybody else?
Oh, me. Because we're trying to implement 802.1x and you know, EAP TTLS. And so, of course, I've been following it, and I'm not really happy about it. Because I was a big PKI person, except even with the dirty little secret of, you know, how well implemented content revocation lists are. And
it turns out that... Safari, I put a post out on my blog this week at Safari browser for OS X doesn't even have OSCP enabled. It's actually been disabled completely.
Right.
So by default, Safari won't check those certificates for revocation, and you'll never know if you've been hijacked. Of course, you need the certificate and a DNS hijack to make something of this, but still, not hard to make a DNS hijack in this day and age. But also, again, staggeringly, these companies make phenomenal amounts of money. It's $1,000 a year for a certificate, for a multi-domain certificate, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and VeriSign plays this little game. You know, if you go to DigiCert, you know, you buy a wild card, you throw it on your load balancers, and it's good for everything. Mm. VeriSign says, oh, no, it's only per host.
Yes.
I'm like, what's the point of buying a wild card then?
You have to pay for host. And you're going, like, hang on. All I've got to do is run this command line on a Unix host, and I've got a certificate. How can it be $1,000 a year to have one of those?
You're not paying for the certificate. You're paying for the trust factor of VeriSign because, you know, if you pay a person enough money, they have to be trustworthy, right?
Well, no. Have you ever noticed that they have insurance. That's what you're paying for. So they say if you get compromised, you can then file a claim. I've never known anybody who's done that. Have you? Do you?
No. And it's probably because there's some kind of wording in the contract that makes it so difficult to actually do one that it's worth less to you. You know, the amount of prestige that you're going to return by saying, hey, it wasn't our fault and we sued VeriSign to that fact, is not worth the thousands or millions of dollars you're going to have to outlay. There was a company in the United States a while back that was doing something very similar called LifeLock, where they insured your personal information from being stolen and identity theft. The problem was is they really, really, really stunk at their job. So bad, in fact, that their big selling point was that the owner of the company gave his real social security number out during the commercials, and it got hacked and reused like 6 times. And the people who were getting these identities stolen were trying to sue, and it turns out that there are certain liability limitations and hoops that you have to jump through. And they looked at it and I was like, okay, it's just cheaper for me to call Visa or American Express and have my cards canceled and own up to the $500 that it's going to cost me to have all those charges reversed than it is to go to court and fight these people for 3 years to maybe get, you know, $100 back after legal fees.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You ever tried suing Microsoft because their products are faulty? How many times have you heard that successful?
And then you know
London
how
Stock
they...
Exchange had an entire the London Stock Exchange put in a Windows network and it blew up 5 times in a year. They eventually replaced it with a Linux system. Do you think they've managed to get any money out of Microsoft?
No.
Like hell. Yeah.
Well, and then companies like Oracle. The other thing you're married to these certificate companies because Oracle application server. I remember we tried to use DigiCert. You know, which was cheaper than VeriSign at the time for a wildcard, but then they only recognize certain CAs, and so we had to then go buy a VeriSign just to use, you know, Oracle application server. It wouldn't work.
Yeah, that'd be a nice deal. Oracle's famous for that. Yeah. They would have gone to VeriSign and said, we'll give you a discount on your Oracle database if you put it into our product.
Right. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, no, they do. They do. VMware recently, their new vCloud product uses Oracle database, whereas in the past they've always used a MySQL version. And then the new vCloud uses Oracle. And the scuttlebutt that I hear is that it was a direct deal from Larry Ellison saying, I'll certify Oracle databases to run in a VM if I get to sell my database in your product. That was the deal. Devil's deal.
Was anyone surprised about this SSL hack?
I am, because these people exist. Their whole business exists on a 95% gross profit margin from generating a bunch of random numbers. Wouldn't you want to protect that business to make sure that your revenue stream comes in every day and have some moderate level of security on it?
Yeah, I mean, the thing for me that I think when Windows 7 got released, there was 170-odd trusted CAs in the software when it comes out. And when you're trying to manage or trust that many things, the attack surface or the attack plane is, you only need one of them to be compromised. So to me, it was just, it was going to come. You know, so the people like VeriSign have got to make sure they've got a good reputation to try and bring the traffic back to them for assigning certificates and try and reduce the width of the routes that are being, route certificates are out there. We need to pull these back in so we can really trust a small defined group rather than these companies.
I didn't realise it was 170 organisations have got route certificates.
I'm sure, I don't have it up in front of me, this is from memory, but I'm sure in the Windows 7 release, there was well over 100 trusted CAs when it came out.
I've had back and forth with people on Twitter because they were asking about trusting GoDaddy SSL certificates. And we've done a little work with that at my office. And basically, a GoDaddy SSL certificate, all it does is keep the certificate warning from popping up in Internet Explorer. It's not any more or less trusted than anybody else. And that's really all these people are concerned about. Is we've trained users to look at that pop-up and go, something's not right here. And now there are so many, and I use the packet pushers, quotey fingers in the air here when I say this, the trusted certificate authorities. I mean, when you have, like John said, over 100 of them that are officially trusted, does it really do you any good to, you know, all you're doing at that point is preventing pop-ups. I don't necessarily know that I trust GoDaddy or any of these other ones versus, you know, VeriSign or Thought or any of the other ones that have been around for a long time. Just, you know, all they're saying is, well, you can trust us to do some investigative work. And obviously Komodo, their investigative work is look at the email. And if they say we need this, the answer is yes.
Yes. For the, yeah, pay money. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Play.
I would expect what you're going to see is a lot of these smaller ones will either get run out of business because the big ones, VeriSign with their Symantec marketing department behind them now, and Thought are going to say, you know what, can you really trust these people? And they're either going to run them out of business, or they're going to offer to purchase for a nominally small fee your customer list and transition those certificates to being trusted by VeriSign. And then when the year comes up and it's time to renew those certificates, oh, look, you're not doing it from, you know, Fly-By-Night Industries anymore. You're having to you're renewing a VeriSign certificate. And if you really want your website to work tomorrow and people to not run from it in droves, you're going to need to buy a VeriSign certificate, which, by the way, is slightly more expensive than the one you were used to buying yesterday.
Well, but when are we going to really do something about CRLs? If CRLs don't work, they're a failure. OCSP is the alternative that's supposed to replace that, and people are turning, you know, it's turned on by default, but when are we going to actually admit that that's what we're supposed to be using instead of depending on CRLs?
I think I saw something that said that the browser manufacturers, the Google and Mozilla and I think Opera, released patches the night before the Komodo hack actually went public that removed that certificate trust, those 8 certificates out of their browser because they were hard-coded. Yeah. And so, I mean, yeah, but the problem is admitting that CRLs don't work because we've spent all of this time telling people CRLs, you have to trust them, you have to use them. If you don't, you know, the world is going to end. Now we have to go back and basically destroy all that conditioning and say, this other thing is better, which, by the way, you need to make sure that you have live connections to the database at all times, and because there could be a flash traffic like this where we have to expire 8 certificates within a few minutes, and what happens if that goes down?
Well, there's legal liability issues here as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you suddenly start, you know, if Google suddenly starts invalidating CRLs on their browser, there's a whole bunch of corporate liability issues. That's why they're not rushing out to disable Komodo certificates in the browser, because Komodo might turn around and start suing them and saying, you're actually taking us out of business.
Well, I have to tell you, from an 802.1x standpoint, the discussion that we're having now is that we're going to do self-signed probably to just because we don't want to deal with this. I mean, it's, you know, so you can't even trust, you know, PKI. So why don't we just do self-signed, at least if they get one of our certs, you know?
It's always been my philosophy is you're better off running your own PKI in an organization, work out, you know, for all the pain of getting that root certificate into the browsers or the applications, at the end of the day, it's as good as or as reliable as, you know, for the cost of inside of an organization that runs, you know, a good sized organization, say with 10,000 employees, probably has 50 to 100 SSL certificates roaming around for different URLs, be it for VPN controllers or web hosting or whatever. You might as well just run a PKI because it's going to cost you the same.
Mm-hmm. And Greg, I know you read that Cisco PKI Uncovered book. We were talking about it when we were out at Wireless Field Day, and they don't mention anything about going to a trusted CA to buy their certificates. They say sign your own.
Absolutely.
You know, now, because you can trust that, and that's one of the things that people have been talking about with Komodo, they're signing all of these certificates with the root CA. That's dumb. I mean, at least when you run your own PKI infrastructure, you can start up the root CA, delegate all everything you need to do, and then you can shut that thing down and lock it in a closet, and you're the only one that has the key.
Yeah, that's right. So what a lot of people don't realize, the best way to manage a root CA is to actually generate it and then turn the machine off.
Exactly.
And then run an intermediate CA for everything from then on. Mm-hmm. I just want to take a break here and remind you that Packet Pushers is looking for sponsors and donations. So I'm going to do a little begging here because the show's getting bigger and bigger and taking on bigger topics, and it's getting harder for me to run the whole thing as a hobby in my spare time. Now, look, typically each show takes between 5 to 8 hours to organise, record, edit and publish, and as a result it's getting to be a real labour for me to bring you the show every week in my spare time. So if you're a company who wants to reach out to 4,000-odd networking nerds who care enough to listen to a technical show like this in their spare time, and they're probably senior or leaders within their respective organisations, then Packet Pushers has a sponsorship option that you should get in contact to talk to us about. It doesn't cost a whole lot, and it gets you very good results. If you're a listener to the show, there's three things that you could do to help us out and make us greater. One, tell other people about us. Couple of reasons. As the numbers grow, it gets easier for me to convince advertisers that it's worth sponsoring the show. It's also easier to get big names and big companies to join in the fun. Tell everyone, leave a review on iTunes, like actually leave a written review, not just give us 5 stars, which for those people who've done it, I'm very pleased about. Blog about the show, talk about us at conferences, make noise on Facebook and Twitter, Google Buzz, wherever you can. More people makes it easier for me to be successful at this. Second, there's a donation button at packetpushers.net. If you can flip me some coffee money to say thanks, well, that would be awesome as well. And finally, subscribe to the mailing list at the Packet Pushers website. Vendors tell me that they'll pay money to be able to send emails to you. Now, look, I'm not entirely happy that that's a great idea, but I'm going to keep your details private. I won't sell the list out to people, and I will send you the content, not somebody else. So I've already set up a mailing service to do this. Most likely, companies who sponsor us with advertisements either on the website or in the podcast will be the only ones allowed to use this list, so I'm going to be careful not to be painful to you. You can find the sign-up form in the sidebar at packetpushers.net. Like I said, looking for some help. Hope you as listeners can help me get this thing going. So we want to bring back some of the user requests. It's been a while since we've chatted to some people about that. And Dominic wrote in and said, first, thanks to the world-class pool of resources for the excellent shows. Thanks, Dominic. It's nice of you to say nice things about us. He works in the government sector and has the opposite task on his desk to build a low-cost data center. So his question is, what do you think is a good vendor and design strategy for building data centers with a low budget? Also, think of things like maintenance. Specifically, there's certain vendors like HP or Avaya who offer free lifetime warranty for their equipment. I would really like to hear your opinion on building low-cost data centers, especially how you get the cheapest 10-gig support in the market. Dominic, listen in. Who wants to go first? Tom?
I've had experience with the lifetime warranty on the equipment from HP mostly. Remember that lifetime support is lifetime replacement support. You're still going to have to pay a maintenance contract to call the TAC if you have a problem. And if you're going to rely on free or low-cost support, be prepared for what you're going to get. I would hope that it would be better on their data center class stuff.
Well, and, most of HP's, for example, the HP Comware stuff is all maintenance-driven. It's only the ProCurve stuff, which is lifetime.
Yeah.
And my understanding is lifetime is only for the life of the model.
Yes.
It's not 20 years or 15 years. It's as long as the model is in support, it's covered for hardware maintenance.
Right. So what they do is they build up stock of that before they retire the line. And when your, and I'll use this as an example, when your 2524, your ProCurve 2524 dies, which is a 100 megabit work group switch, they will send you another one of those. Hmm. They will not send you the replacement model for that because they've got enough of those sitting back. And what they'll probably end up doing when it gets close to the end of life is they'll stop offering new replacements, mm-hmm. and they'll take the ones out of that they've gotten back and repaired and offer refurb replacements.
Yeah.
So, and Cisco has a very similar program with their, what they call them stackable, which would be anything that's like 1RU switches. When you get to anything that's a chassis, which is what we would consider to be data center class, they don't offer a lifetime warranty on that because the idea behind it is, it's not something that you can just ship one box to replace it. It's going to require, real people looking at it to determine what's going on with it. Yep. So don't necessarily let limited lifetime warranties be your only driver for cost, because you're going to end up assuming more cost from your perspective of troubleshooting the problem before you actually call to get the replacement than you will by saying, all right, for X number of dollars a year, I can call their TAC and their TAC will tell me, okay, it seems to be this problem and we're going to go ahead and ship you a replacement. We saved you 6 hours of troubleshooting.
Mm. Well, maintenance is only one part of it, of course.
Right.
My way of managing maintenance is to buy it. Managing maintenance costs is to buy it up front. So when you make your first purchase for your data center, this is assuming that you're buying your data center in one hit, is to tell the vendor I want 5 years of maintenance at purchase time. And all of a sudden, a deal that costs that certainly makes Cisco maintenance look unrealistic at that point, because Cisco maintenance is usually very expensive. But for every $1,000 that you buy, over 5 years, you would expect to spend the same $1,000 again on a maintenance. And because you're buying it all up front in a one lump sum, you can actually get significant maintenance discounts on that.
Yes.
Is one trick.
Yeah.
John, you got any ideas here? You've been doing some data center work lately.
Yeah, I mean, my approach to any of these would be, don't think about the vendor or these sort of things straight off the bat. What you need to do is go and get your requirements for what type of data set you need and look at your budget. And it's once you've got them all written down and you've got some broad agreement, so yeah, these are the requirements that we are, then you go out in the marketplace and look for someone who's got to meet the requirements. Because if you just start going to vendors without structured requirements, then you can get sold any sort of nonsense from them that they feel is good at that point in time. But if you've got your requirements here, then you've got a stake in the ground, so you can say at least it's met the requirements on day one. Mm-hmm. If the requirements change, then you were still right on day one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What? Start with requirements? That's unheard of.
Well, as a bit of a dream of mine to one day actually start with requirements rather than start with a bunch of kit and make it as a jigsaw puzzle.
You still believe in the tooth fairy, don't you, John?
Well, I've still got young kids, yes.
Yes.
It's getting more expensive, the tooth fairy, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Ms. Y?
I mean, working at EDU, I mean, I can say that we're a private university. So, but in a lot of ways, so we get, that sweet EDU discount. And, I'm not going to lie to anybody. And, but we make some of the mistakes that government makes. And, we get talked into roadmaps. We don't have, like you mentioned, we don't, determine our requirements. I mean, I think the best cost-saving move you can make is to follow a PMLC or an SDLC lifecycle. If you determine your requirements, map out, as best you can, where you're going to be in a few years or where you plan to be or hope to be. And I think kind of a KISS idea, keep it as simple as possible. There's nothing like, for example, a Sunbox. I mean, we ran our NTP on Spark stations for probably a decade, and those things were just tanks. They ran forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, on the one hand, as geeks, we like to, we get hooked into all the new, sexy kinds of interesting, but it has that feature. Can we restrain ourselves enough and really focus on the requirements? Instead of focusing on, the features of the equipment to save cost, can we start to think about the intangibles in addition? Can we think about, what are the real costs built into this, this vendor's implementation versus this vendor? What does this mean in terms of support and training and everything else? What's the real ROI? I mean, I think the mistake that we make in this industry is that we just don't do that enough. Hmm. So that's my feeling. I mean, it's not as probably a concrete answer as the gentleman wants, but
yep.
Okay. We make this mistake all the time.
Yeah. Well, my view would be there's a couple of missing bits of information, perhaps, is if I knew how many ports he wanted and what sort of density, whether he had power concerns or things like that. But my immediate response is to go down the path of vendors that you probably haven't thought of. So while I wouldn't consider Huawei, because none of the reports I'm getting back of Huawei equipment are very positive, but it is very, very cost effective. You should also look at Arista and Juniper would be the two I would immediately start to look at. Juniper has a range of stackable switches based around their EX product line, which includes some 10 gig. If your budget can stretch for it, you might be able to get a really good deal on their new QFX stuff, which is their proto fabric stuff. Now, admittedly, you can't get into a full-size fabric solution, but you can get a couple of those switches together to give you a two-port fabric, which, you know, if you're running 10 gig and you only need 30 or 40 10 gig ports, which is a pretty big VMware cluster when you think about it, you can actually get a fair bit of lead out of that. I reckon Juniper would fall over themselves to get some reference sites for QFX, so go and knock on their door and have a chat. Arista is another one. Heard very good things about Arista products from a few of the financial institutions I've spoken to, and you might want to talk to them again. Very keen to get some business done, get some market share, so they may offer you a very, very good deal.
But we have some Arista, and we've looked at some Juniper, and sometimes the problems that you get into with Arista is, you know, in some of these newer companies is, and we've dealt with a lot of newer companies, is that what you gain in cost saving or maybe some really sexy new features because they're experimenting with new things is
pain.
You know, the alternative is that, okay, their support isn't always what you get, say, from Cisco.
Yeah.
And then Juniper's kind of going through some growing pains in terms of, you know, the SRXs and we've had some weird experiences with their SSL VPN and their ICs, you know, the UAC stuff, the NAC.
I think everybody's UAC and SSL VPN is fundamentally balked. Cisco's SSL VPN has any number of pain points around configuration. You can type stuff into it and it just doesn't take, or you put it in on the
right.
CLI and it doesn't show up on the, you know, the browser. It works with this browser but not with that. I think all SSL VPNs remain fundamentally challenged at this point in time. They kind of work about 95% of the time.
I mean, we actually bought, I remember we bought ID Engines. Because we thought, you know, they were a smaller company. They offered a solution that nobody else offered.
Yeah.
We bought them, and then they went out of business. Their intellectual property got bought by Nortel, who then got bought by Avaya. And we ended up with some very expensive doorstops.
Yep.
So what we thought we were kind of saving and then, you know, in a really good solution and everything else, we ended up, you know, losing out.
I'm not disagreeing. What I'm saying is out of the two, Arista and Juniper seem to me to be well positioned going forward. Out of those two. I wouldn't buy Avaya because he's in Germany and Avaya has bugger all presence in Europe. Mm. For all intents and purposes, there's a handful of people around the place, but they have almost no tech support and no profile. And the ERS 8600 and 8800 product has legendary bugs on really, really common things. Hi, Michael McNamara. Be well, man. So if I had to pick an off, so if I wasn't going to go with Cisco because Cisco likes to be reassuringly expensive and charge generously up front and then charge even more generously for the ability to get maintenance on that product, I don't think you would even consider them in a price-sensitive account. So if I take Cisco out of the equation, and I agree with what you're saying, in the long term, you're possibly going to get better served with Cisco, possibly. But if you can't go off onto Cisco, then I would choose Arista or Juniper would be my bet today.
Hmm.
If I'm getting down to brass tacks. Second thing is, stick with multi-mode on your 10 gig. Don't go and buy single mode. Go for coax if you can, but those coax transceivers are really very expensive. Look for cabling solutions on 10 gig that are practical. So go and do your research on your cabling. Use click-clack. Don't use pre-made pigtails where you actually fusion splice them into your data center. I'm assuming that power is not too much of an issue, so you may not be too interested in the fact that Arista, for example, has very low-powered devices. Their use of silicon is fairly generously they lean to the lower end of the power consumption, but if that's an issue, then that might be something that you're interested in. Your second decision would be stackables versus chassis. Now, while I may have an opinion that stackables, you shouldn't urinate on them even if they're on fire because you should let them burn, I genuinely think that for a smaller data center, perhaps of a modest size and a modest cost, a stackable can work. I would assume that because your data center is at a lower cost, you probably also have a lower SLA, so you can probably afford to have a few outages, otherwise you'd be spending serious money on it. So this is why I was saying the Juniper EX would be a good look. Their stackable stuff has some really interesting things where they actually have up to 5 meter cables that can hang between those EX switches, which means you can actually have top of rack, run a stacking cable across the top with 128 gigabit per second bus between them all, which isn't bad for the money. It's quite a good design that actually scales out for a nice low cost data center. I think I've done. Have I rabbited on enough?
I think you got all the good info out there.
Yeah, I think we covered everything. We did the good stuff, the stuff that all comes out of the textbook. And then I've rabbited on about what I think about that sort of stuff. The second topic that's come in is from Paul. Paul says, here's a question you might like to cover sometime on the podcast. What are the relative advantages and disadvantages of routing in an L3 switch versus a traditional router? Say, for example, a Juniper EX3200 versus an MX80. When would you always choose one, and when would you never choose it? Specifically, he's looking to put in a pair of routing switches between his campus VLANs and possibly between them and my 100 megabit per second internet link. And I have, there's a recurring theme here today, minimal budget. Which type of device would be a better choice from a performance and a resilience perspective? Tom, do you want to lead out on that one?
Well, I mean, the basics between a layer 3 switch and a router come down to circuitry. Routers perform all the routing functions in software and use the CPU on the router, whereas a layer 3 switch will use an ASIC to do the layer 3 routing. So it's faster. The problem is that you lose the advantage of doing things in software, like QoS. So, for instance, if you're using, and I'll speak to Cisco because that's where most of my experience is, while you can do lightning-fast routing with a 3550 or a 3560, you lose a lot of QoS capabilities because of the limitations of the platform, because the QoS ASIC can only do inbound QoS. It has a really hard time doing any kind of outbound QoS. So if you're going to have to do a lot of software-type support on a routed link, I would say you'd probably want to lean more towards a router, which has a bigger CPU that's capable of doing more to the data once you get it in the chassis, versus if all you're caring about is throwing bits here and there as fast as possible, layer 3 switch is probably going to be the one way you're going to want to go. And of course, you know, the most experience that I've had doing layer 3 switches versus routers has been when the media type has dictated what I have to use, because there are some media types that you can get on switches that are not available on routers.
True. Mrs. Y?
That's, we don't really approach it from a way to save money. We try to keep it. Our primary driving force in our network is fast, fast, fast. Wait, it's not fast enough. I mean, that's going to be the motivation behind everything we do. And we don't even have a distribution layer to our network. Actually have, and we have fiber for a while. One of our initiatives was fiber to the desktop. And you don't want to know the horror stories of that.
I was there. I've actually done ATM to the desktop.
We did that.
Yeah.
We were an ATM backbone for a while.
Oh, yeah. Bring that back. I mean, we need more of that.
Yeah.
I can give you a good story about ATM.
Shoot.
This is going back years ago, working with HP, and we'd done a fantastic design. We're building the test environment, and it was going to cross one side in the UK, one side, and I think it was out by Pittsburgh. So they had spec'd all these ProLiant servers, and we got to site and we got it connected up to the comms room. And it was probably just 100 meg ports at the time, maybe could get a push. So he's right, where can we plug this into? I don't have any copper ports on site. We're in the place we're in, I think it was 4 systems, which Marconi had bought. Mm-hmm. And they were an ATM manufacturer, so everything on the site was ATM.
Yeah.
Then someone had, they'll just put these servers, it'll be fine, we'll just plug them in when we get there. No, you won't.
They would have been using, they used 25 meg ATM to the desktop at that point. Yeah.
Yeah, it was bizarre, but yeah, it's just been completely overlooked in the project that, yeah, we'll plug these into the other side of the Atlantic and it'll be fine.
I want to go back to the days of ATM, Token Ring and FIDI and Ethernet, and we had them all in one LAN. Sorry, Mrs. Y, I interrupted you.
No. It's so we don't really think about. So that's going to be the motivation behind everything we choose. Hmm. We're going to say, okay, which is faster? Oh, you know, and it's not. We'll justify it because you know they're because of research and technology and I2, and we'll say, oh, but for research purposes, we need 10 gig, you know, for our backbone.
But you're also talking. Tens of thousands of students doing weird stuff in addition to the research stuff.
Yeah, and you know what? Your porn can never be fast enough.
Truer words. words were never spoken.
Those students, they need it, you know, they want it really fast.
Well, yeah, when you're that age. I've heard stories that things are like that. So my toughens worth, for what it's worth, is that if you are routing between campus VLANs, use a silicon switch. That is a layer 3 switch, which is also a router. The argument between a layer 3 switch or routing is largely arbitrary. So I would route between VLANs with an EX3200, as you suggest. The reason being is that when you're routing between VLANs, what you're really trying to do is to do broadcast suppression so that the VLAN is not overly large. As a result, you're focusing on performance. So two devices on a campus LAN routing through the engine. The switch will be doing layer 3 routing in silicon, and it'll go like the clappers. That's great. When you get to the edge of your network, say between the 100 meg internet link, you're probably looking for more features in a device. So you're looking for access lists, quality of service. You probably want to do something on an internet link that says, I've got 100 megabits per second. I want no more than 20 megabits per second of SMTP, no more than 60 megabits per second of HTTP, so that other services can continue to work and they don't overthrottle. It's not perfect, but you know, those sorts of QoS features are not possible in a silicon switch, because the silicon engine, the way that the packets are forwarded, is all done down in the guts, and it all has to be programmed into the chip. You don't get unlimited numbers of buffers or dynamic buffering capabilities or sophisticated memory handling or classification algorithms. That requires a CPU with software, as what Tom said earlier on. So my view would be, use the layer 3 switch, as you say, with a Juniper EX, and then find a router to handle your internet link. If it's only 100 megabits per second, get something small and cheap. For example, in the Cisco range, you could go right the way down to a 3900, which would easily handle 100 megabits per second internet link without any, and only cost, you know, a few tens of thousands. And you'd have lots of features in there that you could fiddle around with to your heart's content. It can be a VPN service, it can be a CA, it can be quossed up the wazoo with firewall code, zone-based firewalls, multi-DMZs, the whole lot. So different purposes for different things. Layer 3 routing in a switch is simple, fast, and suitable for routing between VLANs in the LAN. And then on WAN links, you would tend towards an iOS router because of the sophistication that you can bring to bear in terms of configuration. iOS SX, which is in Cisco land, is very simplistic, very limited, very functionally deficient compared to iOS, which goes into their routers because it has a completely different way of attacking the code, completely different architecture underneath.
In fact, I like what Greg just said about, it's exactly the way we have our network in terms of internally, it's all VLANs and layer 3 switches, and then externally we have border routers, Juniper border routers. So,
I've just bought an ASA today on. just for my own amusement.
I really hate those devices.
Yeah. Well, it's on a secure. I've got to have a look at the security blueprint just to get myself up to speed on. I've got a tip of the week for any network engineers out there. Specifically around doing password recovery on a system that has two supervisors or two root processors. So, for example, on the ASR1006, and you want to do password recovery, my tip would be take out one of the root processors and do password recovery on the one that's still on the chassis. Then once you've got everything recovered and the system's up and running, insert your other root processor, and that will take the config back across. And there's no hassle about getting the booting between root processors while you're going through the password recovery process. There you go.
That's a good tip. So you had problems with recovering it the other way around?
Well, it seemed to be that when we put the ARM on through the setup process and you choose to no boot into, to ignore the startup config, it would reboot and just load up the startup config. Next thought as well, let's get one of the root processors out the way. And so we're just working on one that came up fine.
Okay.
But also during that process, I managed to write mem over the startup config, so we actually had to pull out the root processor we're trying to recover on.
That's a good tip. I'll remember that. And if anybody else has any questions that they'd like to ask us or any tips they'd like to email into us, then please feel free to do so to packetpushers@gmail.com. Do we want to do the firewall things now, Mrs. Y, or do you want to save them for some time in the future?
I'm just, all I've been doing is playing with wireless security for the last couple of weeks. So wireless hacking. I'm trying to get a tool set. I mean, other than hating firewalls and the idea of firewalls, I mean, I'm really focused on building a kit for packet injection, stress testing, and spectrum analysis, and trying to really, because we have a very large wireless network. And then
you'll have to listen to our Tech Field Day episode. It'll go out tomorrow.
Oh,
all
cool.
We do is talk about spectrum analyzers. We actually went to the Tech Field Day, and they gave us an air magnet and a Wi-Spy.
Oh, I like the Wi-Spys. They're very reasonably priced. And,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we said.
I was very impressed.
Basically, if I ever see another wireless engineer in my customer's sites and he hasn't got a Wi-Spy, I'm going to kick him back out.
Well, you know, you can, yeah, Wi-Spy is good for, you know, external interference, but there's a lot of great poor man stuff that you can get out there, you know, to do pen testing and to do packet injection for stress testing. You know, I got a $30 Alpha card that's going to work on the Mac. I can either use it with Backtrack for packet injection in a VM, or I can use it with Kismac. And
well, I tell you what, why don't we hold this over and we'll run this again next weekend?
Sure.
Do you want to come back next week Sunday?
Yeah, sure.
We'll assemble the same crew. Is that all right with you, Tom and John?
It works for me.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
All right. That's next weekend's show worked out. All right, so that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Tom, what are you doing this week?
Oh, I've already got my week scheduled out. I'm going to play Network Firefighter for the next 3 or 4 days and try to come up with some really ingenious ways to make things work. And hopefully I'll have some time to make some comments about any more security breaches on my blog at networkingnerd.net, and then make fun of people on my Twitter feed at networkingnerd.
All snark all the time. And John, exactly. John, what are you going to be doing this week?
I'm going to be looking at encrypting a wide area network, and you can find me at now networking-guru.net and on Twitter at _John McManus_.
And of course, Mrs. Y, what's happening with you?
I'm going to be playing with wireless security. I'm very focused on that. And also, please offer me your condolences, because I have to work with Radius for the next 2 weeks. You know, Radius is that thing that some guy set up 10 years ago and everybody goes, don't touch it. It works. So I have to we're trying to figure out what we're going to do moving forward for 802.1x. And I'm trying to decide between Radiator, Free Radius, which you know, is, unless you're a masochist.
Yeah, you know. If you've used Free Radius, you just know.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like, and if you ask a question, it's like, what? You don't know that? Why are you posting such a stupid question?
Yeah, that's right.
You know? And then we're also looking a little bit at steel belted Radius, but we've just had a lot of pain with Radius. So, and for some reason, I got stuck with it.
I always love the fact that there's diameter, which is supposedly twice as good as radius.
You know, somebody always has to bring up diameter. It's like, you know, diameter is like the DNSSEC of the authentication,
right.
You know.
And it's the ITU standard for radius. Not content with just solving the problem, they had to solve all the problems that have ever existed and all the problems from tomorrow and all of the problems that we're never, ever going to face, but there's an answer.
Well, it's like, you know, that competitor to DNSSEC, which is DNS curve. You know, is anybody using, you know, just because Daniel Bernstein could do it, he did it, you know? Is anybody actually using it?
Come on, give me a break. And, of course, I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on the Twitter as at etherealmind. Of course, we'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. Just remember that I've been begging you for your help, so leave feedback on iTunes, tell your friends, rave about it on Facebook and Twitter, throw me a donation on the podcast website. That would all be appreciated. And if you know somebody who you think would sponsor the show, get in contact with me via the podcast website at packetpushers.net or follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. And remember that too much networking would never be enough.